Okay, so welcome back to The London Architect. This is our seventh episode. Today we have John Duffett with us. John, do you want to just start by telling us a little bit about Yard Architects and what kind of practice it is, who you run it with?
Sure. Thanks for having me on as well, Lily. It's appreciated. So Yard Architects are a small residential practice, I think we define ourselves as, and we work on design-led residential work, which can be anything from small extensions to refurbishments to new build houses.
Yeah. And you run the practice with your friend Simon.
Yeah. My
friend and business partner, yes.
My co-director, Simon.
Yes.
We're definitely friends. We started off working together.
Yeah.
So that's how we started. We started as colleagues and, yeah, embarked on business, and we haven't broken up yet.
Lovely. It's the most natural way for it. So if we could just start sort of with your, let's say, passion for architecture, although I keep being told off for using the word passion recently. On your bio on the website, it says that you created an Andy Goldsworthy inspired tree sculpture when you did A-level art, and that kind of still holds a place in your heart now, and it's something that you want to recreate in retirement. Is that what it says on the website?
It does. It's all true. I would love to do that. That's almost anti-architecture, though. That's as in something created before the career, and I would like to do more of it. But really, it comes from, I guess, a passion for making and creating things.
Yeah.
Which I enjoyed exploring when I did my A-level art, which I guess ultimately meant that, I guess, the A-level art was a way of cementing the fact that I knew that I enjoyed working three-dimensionally in a creative way, which then, continued through architecture.
Is that when you first did that plant the seed of a career in architecture, or had you already considered it?
I considered it before then. So when it came to doing A-levels, I did my research. I was told I should do art, maths and physics. And they were the three best subjects to get into sort of the best architecture schools, which worked out for me. I was happy with all of them.
But
I was very lucky to be in at Sixth Form College, which had an incredible art department.
Mm-hmm.
And there was I was in the sculpture department with a teacher called Richard, who was heroic. And it was it was the sort of experience that I think a lot of people had when they went to university.
Yeah.
We would hang out in the art department. That was where we spent our free time. We were encouraged to work in all sorts of different media and different ways. And that project came about from me and my dad going and cutting down a bit of tree in a field behind our house and me getting him to drive it into college and carving it up.
You already thought that architecture was sort of cool when you were in school. It wasn't something that came to you after that. Like, that's fairly early on, I guess.
Yeah. So I think when I was at secondary school, I can't remember exactly when, I guess around year nine or so, it was something that I was passionate about. Passion is the right word, I think.
Yeah. No, say it. I did.
And it just seemed fun. It seemed like a fun thing in terms of the ability, particularly in education, to be learning whilst creating, and there being a career at the end of it, I think was something that seemed attractive to me.
Yeah, definitely. So you said in our pre-meet that it kind of introduced you to experimentation. Is that something that you've carried with you? You then went to university to do your part one at Nottingham, right?
Yeah.
Is that something that you kind of continued during your degree studies?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, every architecture school is different. So when people are looking into doing architecture, you find out through research and through visiting the different schools have slightly different emphasis.
Mm-hmm.
And at Nottingham, I think it was quite a balanced course, which meant that there were some tutors there who had a really creative agenda. And then there was a lot on the technical side as well.
Mm-hmm.
They actually did a lot of research there, which got them lots of points to keep them at the top of the table. But we didn't get to see that much of that as students. But no, it was a good balanced course. I think it was clearly being influenced by some influential schools at the time. So the Bartlett, which still is a well-regarded school, mm-hmm. had some tricky times recently. But at the time where I started at Nottingham, it was very trendy. And I think there was something about Nottingham that was trying to implement some of the ethos that operated at the Bartlett, which meant that there were tutors coming across. They started creating sort of studios in the same way that they did at the Bartlett.
Yeah.
So it was kind of finding its identity at the time, which mm-hmm. was interesting. But yeah, it provided a great balance and meant that we had some good, really good tutors we were working with.
Yeah. So did a lot of people follow your route, like from Nottingham to the Bartlett? Was that quite a popular place to go for the part two?
Some of us did. There weren't that many from my year that went to the Bartlett. A lot of people came to London. Mm-hmm. So the way it was, and I came out of uni in 2004 for my undergrad, mm-hmm. There was a lot of workarounds and there was a lot of work in London.
Yeah.
So it seemed to be ridiculously easy compared to now, I think, to be able to come to London, find a job, find an affordable rented flat and...
Was it like the real London dream? You sort of lived it, like you come straight to London after.
Yeah.
And yeah, it all happened.
So. Yeah, it was incredible. I remember my, the job that I got, I remember going down for my interview. Mm. I was sat on outside a cafe in Exmouth Market.
Yeah.
And thinking that this is incredible. This is the dream.
Yeah.
I want to be here. I want to work here. And managed to make it happen. I had to hassle a lot for it to get the job. I was interviewed. I think I was one of about 10 people who were interviewed for the position. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for me to hear anything back. Mm. But I phoned up the studio and I hassled and I asked to speak to the director who was in charge of recruiting. I got the job and I found out later down the line it was pretty much because of that phone call. It was me or someone else, but because I was the one who hassled and showed some commitment, wanted to get it, that was why I got it. So which is, I think, something which is important for everyone to sort of remember if you're trying to build your career or start your career.
Yeah.
It is important. You need to be able to back it up.
Yeah.
But if you just sit there on the sidelines, it might not necessarily work out as you want.
It's about human connection, you know. We're always hiding behind screens nowadays, but it's great that you could actually kind of reach out to someone like that. So whilst you were studying your part two, you went and you were involved in a community outreach project in Alabama, right?
Yeah, well, we had a field trip to Alabama, which was incredible. And as part of that, we spent some time with Rural Studio, which was an amazing project that was happening out there, where it was basically established within really deprived town in Alabama, where there were students who were on the full outreach project who would be there for 6 months or a year designing and building homes and community buildings for the people who lived there. And there were projects such as houses built using carpet tiles, and there was a chapel built using leftover like car windows that were taken from a scrapyard, and all sorts of really inventive ways to make buildings in an interesting way, but very community led. So yeah, that was an incredible thing to see.
Like,
I only saw a bit of it, but it was fascinating project.
Yeah, sorry, you just dipped your toes into it, but I mean, what did that kind of, what perspectives did that expose you to that you were able to bring back to the UK?
I think definitely it reinforced the sense of being confident in experimenting. Mm. So seeing real world projects where people are building houses and cultural centres using highly unorthodox materials for a very low cost was really useful to see. I think a lot of people's university experience, particularly in architecture, they speak very fairly about how a lot of our projects are based in this magical world.
Yeah.
It's not set in reality.
Yeah.
So I think it's really good for tutors to be able to expose students to real world projects.
Yeah.
So that you can see that it can happen and also see the effect that it has on people.
Yeah.
And the importance of working with, even if it's not the community, I mean, we work within our practice on private houses mostly, but we work with the people, with the families and individuals who we're creating architecture for and with. So I think it was really good for reinforcing the importance of that human connection and ability to experiment.
Would you say that that kind of gave you some skills for starting your own practice, you know, the sort of foundational ethos of architecture and, you know, what you need to get it going. Have you ever sort of thought about that?
I think when we set up the practice, we very much knew we wanted it to be a client-focused practice. That was a very big thing for us.
Yeah.
It kind of has to be when you're working with private residential, and we enjoy that, which is why we work on it.
Yeah.
But yeah, ultimately it boils down to creating spaces for people.
Yeah.
So in exactly the same way as we saw out in Alabama, that's fundamentally what we're doing.
Yeah. So you started Yard Architects in 2014, right?
Yeah.
And tell us about the name. Where did that come from? Who came up with it?
Good question. So I think from the outset, Simon and I were very keen that we didn't want to use our own names within the practice.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason for that was that we wanted to build a studio where our staff felt enfranchised in the business and in the work that they're creating. So rather than it just being work that Simon and I create and our names being above the door, we like the idea that ultimately Yard is a collective of people
yes.
who we work with. Mm. So we kind of wanted to try and take ourselves out of it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So we had that on one side, and then we did the thing that people do, I guess. We created a long list of names. Simon made one, I made one.
Wow.
We crossed off the ones we hate. It's like choosing a name for a baby.
Yeah, yeah.
And
More important.
Yeah. And we wanted something that was short, snappy, looked good graphically.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's where we ended up.
No, it kind of, well, I mean, it links to the industry as well. Yard, I guess that's sort of what you start off with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's multifaceted and obviously, you know, as it refers to a parcel of land, which we're working with it with, a unit of measurements as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, covers a few bases.
Yeah. So am I correct in thinking that you've got about 6 employees at the moment, including
us? It's 6.
Yeah.
Nearly 7. I think 7 on Monday.
Oh, exciting.
But yes. Yeah.
And what's the recruitment process like? Is that in-house? Like, I don't really know how recruitment works for architecture.
Well, for us, it works mostly in one way, in that we tend to post jobs on Dezeen. So that seems to have taken over the last 10 years as the primary source of recruitment for most people, I think. There are recruitment agencies out there who could be really good for senior positions, perhaps, and for larger firms. But we tend to do that. But we also, you know, use social media. So we'll post it on Instagram, and we always get inquiries through that. We get quite a few speculative applications, which are interesting. Sometimes they're worth it. But the thing is, we're so busy. We have so many emails. I think you have to be really lucky if you send across a speculative application.
Yeah.
If we're thinking about recruiting.
Yeah.
And that comes through and it looks good, then that's great.
Yeah.
But if you send, even if you're the best applicant in the world, if you send something across and 6 months before or after any form of recruitment, then it may not work out. But,
yeah.
So I think, yeah, if people are looking to get a job within architecture, it really pays to follow the boards on Dezeen, to follow your favorite firms and just try and keep tabs on when people are recruiting.
Yeah.
Try and make sure that applications are relevant as well.
Have you had anyone calling you up like you did when you tried to get your first job?
We do. Not enough.
Really?
Have we ever had anyone who's chased us after an interview? Possibly not, but maybe we've acted a bit faster than on my first job.
Hmm.
But yeah, we do get some people phoning up. We've had people walk in.
Mm-hmm.
We took on a work experience student recently. I probably shouldn't say this. Don't everyone do this. But we took on a work experience student recently whose mum marched him into our studio.
Wow.
And he had a placement to fill for his summer week's work experience.
Mm.
And she took him, she thought the architecture might work for him. She took him around to a few local practices. She had a CV. She gave a great speech. Very hard to say no.
So, oh my God. So
very direct approach.
Wow. And how did he feel about that?
Well, we made him aware by the end of his time that he was very lucky to have
such
a great mum who did that for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was, I think he was the only one of his, like, none of his friends got jobs at Work Experience. So he was the only one who was doing it during that week.
Yeah.
I think he was appreciative of that.
Well, there you go, kids. That's the way forward, you know? Get your mum to go in with you. So I just wanted to chat a bit about your bio on your website. Mm-hmm. So it says that your ethos is to create intelligent and practical spaces with an emphasis on craftsmanship, quality of light, and a sense of timelessness. And I was wondering how you go about in creating a sense of timelessness. It's quite an ambiguous sort of idea.
It is. It's an ambitious statement, isn't it? And we probably wrote it quite some time ago, since the time I read it. How do we create an essence of time, an atmosphere of timelessness? I mean, I guess that speaks to the fact that we tend to respond to projects in relation to context and brief and try not to churn out the same thing or the trendy thing. I don't really mind fashion when it comes to architecture, really. Sometimes it's fun. Clients tend to enjoy it as well. So it's not something where we eschew anything that we see too much of. But I think in terms of timelessness, it's more about really making sure that we're responding to conditions such as light and space and economy and feel and materiality, things like that, that are ultimately timeless.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're using materials that maybe are available now that weren't available in the past, but just making sure that we're, I guess, dealing with the sort of real essence of architecture and space is what that means.
Yes. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So could you sort of run us through a day in the life of John, you know, before we go on to discuss a couple of your projects? I was wondering, what does an average day look like?
What does an average day look like? Well, the first thing to say, I guess, is that it's very varied because it depends on things like whether we're dealing with lots of new inquiries, whether how much stuff we've got on site, whether we've got client meetings coming up. So it's one of the things I've always enjoyed, particularly working in small architecture practices, is that you can have an incredibly varied day. So it's not like, I'm almost envious sometimes when I cycle into work and I see the lycra clad commuters who I know have got every day they can go into the office, have a shower, change into their clothes, come home. That doesn't exist. It's different every day, and for me to do that means I need to carry clothes around everywhere. So
it's always prepared.
There's always lots going on. I mean, a typical day is that I might get up, and if I take, I guess, 3 days out of five, I might get up, go for a run first thing in the morning. I take my kids to school. So it's something which is kind of part of the attraction, I guess, of having a business. But it's something that we haven't had staff who have had kids before. But if that was the case, then we'd be very open to them being able to do that.
Yeah.
I really enjoy being able to do that. I drop my kids off at school and then ordinarily come into the office on my bike. So I might get in at 9:15, 9:30. And then I think the first thing would probably be a catch up with the guys who are working on my project. So the way it tends to work in our studio is that Simon and I tend to divide up the project. So I lead half, he leads the other half. So I might catch up with the guys on what they're doing there. Inevitably, there's probably a meeting booked in somewhere, maybe a virtual one, maybe going to somebody's house, maybe a site visit where we would go and check on progress, etc., deal with builders' queries. Back to the office, try and sort out any emails that need to be done, and then head back home in the evening.
Okay, nice. Yeah, it sounds like a pretty fulfilling day. You say that you and Simon decided to sort of take on your own projects. Did you ever try to like work on the same ones and then get to the point where you were like, no, let's just like divide it up? Or was it always from the get-go?
Maybe our very first few projects, we do work together. We used to work together, I think, a lot more in the very early days, where we'd literally just be the two of us sat there, you know, pinging every idea off each other. And now it's more as a studio. So I do that with the people next to me who aren't necessarily Simon. But no, we've always been with a sort of practice where we both have very similar skills, I think. So we both do a bit of everything.
Yeah.
It's not that one of us does one thing.
Yeah.
The other does the other. So no, it tends to balance out in that if we take the lead on an initial inquiry mm-hmm. and we follow it through, we win the project, then often it's whoever does that who takes it on, and it okay. tends to balance out.
Yeah. Good division of labor. So let's talk about the Peckham shell only custom build that you've recently done, and that's on your website as well. Could yeah. you explain to our listeners what a shell only build is?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating project for me. But yeah, a shell only build, it basically means that the developer in this instance, who developed the plot and built five houses on it, just built the external envelope of the houses and left it up to the purchasers to finish them off and fit it out. So it's like a half-built building,
yeah.
ultimately.
Okay.
Yeah.
And does that kind of make any difference for you in the part that you play there? Does it make it easier? Does it make it harder? Or just is this sort of the same?
I think like lots of things in architecture, it was probably a bit of both. Mm. I think I thought it was going to be easier to start with. I mean, we're used to working on lots of Victorian terraced houses and mm-hmm. and such like. And we're kind of used to how they work. This shell house was built as a timber frame
yeah.
construction. We do loads of timber frame construction, mm-hmm. but normally we're doing that as a new build or as a new element. Mm-hmm. So to inherit a timber framed shell and then have to divide it up and bear structure onto things where you don't have columns and beams in the right locations. You don't have solid masonry walls that you can bear upon. Made it actually a lot more complicated. So we had to have an ingenious engineer to try and find ways to spread loads around bits of a timber frame shell that it was otherwise going to be really difficult to do. So that was interesting and perhaps slightly unexpected. Mm-hmm. It felt like a really good project to be able to sell to builders. They mm-hmm. only had to do an interior fit out, but it was more than an interior fit out. They mm-hmm. didn't have to have ground workers mm-hmm. trudging around in the, doing footings and underpinning and things like this, mm-hmm. which also de-risked it for the client, which is really good. So mm-hmm. people often come into trouble in the ground and in getting the shell complete. So with that already done, for the builder coming onto the project, it was a more attractive prospect.
And it received an A rating for its energy performance certificate.
It did.
So could you just explain that to our listeners, what that kind of means?
Yeah. So that basically means that it performs incredibly well environmentally, has a very low requirement for energy usage and the expenditure of carbon through heating and electricity, etc. So that was achieved in part by the developer who built the shells firstly in a highly insulated way with triple glazing. Mm-hmm. But then it was followed through by us and the clients through basically completing the fit out and including things like photovoltaic panels, air source heat pumps, mm-hmm. Additional insulation in sections, installing an MVHR system.
Yeah.
Which manages the background ventilation. So, no, it was really key as we were going through the project and going through the detailed design. We had an M&E consultant on board to help us with it. Mm-hmm. Everyone was really highly motivated to make sure that it performed really well, from okay. the clients to the M&E guys to us.
Yeah.
Which is really important and you need if you want to deliver an energy efficient house. Yeah. Everyone has to be pulling in the right direction.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it basically means that it becomes quite close to a sort of passive house, standard type mm-hmm. house. But without going into other more complex aspects of passive house that would yeah. have been possible in this instance.
Yeah. So another one of your projects is called the House of Reflection. Mm. Where was that one again? In Westminster?
Westbourne Grove, yeah.
Westbourne
Grove. Yeah, within Westminster, near Nottingham.
And this project was a little bit of a roller coaster for you. It was over quite a long period of time, was it?
It was.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. I mean, it was one of our first big projects that Simon and I won. Mm-hmm. And so I think we would only been going, I think it started maybe 7 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And we were the project was passed to us by somebody who Simon used to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows the value of staying in touch with previous practices, things like that. So this was a firm where he worked. They'd done a couple of schemes on the site before. So there was an old garage conversion that was on this site. And they had had two planning consents for new build houses.
Mm-hmm.
But then our client bought the site. He wanted to look at doing something different.
Yeah.
These both had like double basements. He didn't need that.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted something a little bit different and got in touch with that practice initially, mm-hmm. who then put him in contact with us.
Okay.
So we were delighted to win it. It was the best project we'd ever had. It was the opportunity for us to build a new build house. And on a really interesting site. So absolutely the sort of thing that got us going. We worked through the design stages. It was such a tight plot that we designed a house which basically occupied the entire plot apart from a courtyard in the middle,
mm-hmm.
sort of shaped like a donut. There's very little opportunity. Yeah, there's very little opportunity for glazing on the boundaries. So mm-hmm. the courtyard became a shaft where we get light in. But we also created an element where we had a series of double height spaces sort of elevated from the upper ground floor, which acted as a lantern to sort of get light in through clear story glazing from high level. And we designed what was a wonderful but quite complex house.
Mm.
But we got planning consent for it first time, which everyone was delighted by.
Yeah.
We were really excited about delivering it. Our client took us out for lunch to celebrate. And while we were out for lunch, I was telling him about a recent trip to Belgium, how we had to go. I'd been to Ghent for a few days. It was wonderful. And he took me up on my advice, took a trip to Belgium and loved it so much that he decided to move there.
Oh, my God.
So it turned from a nice little lunchtime chat to the project being gone.
So
we received the news. We got in touch with him to talk about, pushing forward with the next stages. Mm. And we were heartbroken because he told us he was going to try and sell the site because he was resettling in Antwerp.
God, were you annoyed at yourself at this point? I mean,
of course, slightly, but I mean, we could never have. Yeah, could never have foreseen.
You never
that
knew he would.
No chance. So I mean, exactly. I mean, we were delighted. It was a fun, in a way, for him. It was a really good opportunity.
Yeah.
He's an art dealer, and he set up a gallery over there. And mm-hmm. it was obviously a really exciting stage of his life. Just less good for us.
Happy for him.
Yeah. But then it got better. So from a selfish perspective, it did anyway.
Yeah.
He really struggled to sell the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And what this meant is that after about 3 years, he felt homesick. Mm-hmm. He decided he wanted to come back to London.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't got a price that was good enough for him to sell the plot. So the project came back to life, which was brilliant. So that was fantastic news for us, as a practice. And it meant that Simon and I got to delve back in and try and deliver this ridiculously complicated house that we'd designed for a planning stage was fantastic, and a technical design stage became tricky. But we did deliver it. It happened. It was on site during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
There were all sorts of complications during the build.
Mm-hmm.
There were numerous issues with party wall awards and neighbors as a result of the highly restricted site.
Yeah.
I mean, it was incredible. The builders built their site offices on top of the house. So they built a scaffold over where they were building the house, located their site offices above that because there was nowhere else to put them.
Wow.
So it was a really fascinating build to watch. But it worked out. We delivered it. He was absolutely delighted. He is absolutely delighted. So he's happily living in there now, and we're really happy with the final results.
So the project, the building is very unique, but it still relates to the surrounding architecture. How did you manage that?
Well, again, I guess going back to my point of designing around the context.
Yeah.
There are parts of sort of designing buildings that you want to respond to the immediate cityscape so that they might feel familiar to people. And also another aspect of it is finding drivers for the design. What are we, rather than designing something that's completely arbitrary and dropped into place, what are we responding to? So we had this series of layers of building that were starting to develop when we were looking at initial designs, from sort of basement level to ground floor sections to lanterns. And we had like this existing wall at the front that we were nestling behind. Mm-hmm. And there were buildings nearby that basically had different series of strata of different materials and profiles that we thought was really interesting to respond to. So we were responding to color and materiality, which meant that things like a London stock brick at high level on our building ended up being like a bronze mesh that was a similar color to the London stock brick, and white stucco bands became like Roman, like white Roman profile brickwork in certain strata. So yeah, we sort of interpreted it in different ways as a driver for design and integration, which I think worked out.
And how do you sort of manage and maintain healthy relationships throughout projects like this that can be quite challenging? Relationships with the contractors, with the client, how often are you meeting up, discussing, sharing ideas? Are you, how often are you on site as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key driver for maintaining and building good relationships with anyone is having an environment of openness and honesty around things. So I think that's something where from the early stages, when it comes to difficulties in design or meeting the brief, sometimes clients come to you with briefs that you just can't deliver and there's no point pretending. You have to find solutions to it. But we always are very open if we can't do something or something is problematic, which I think then sets a really good it sets your stall out for the rest of the project. So it becomes easier to talk about any issues that do arise on sites or around cost or various details. So I think that's the absolute fundamental. Good communication is definitely really important, and regular communication. So, I mean, in terms of projects that we run on site, for the vast majority, we go to site every week. Often one of those is an informal visit with the builder where we just get to talk about whatever they want to talk about. And then we'll have a formal one where we're tracking progress and program. And again, making sure that we're keeping everyone up to date on the status of the project. I think they're the sort of foundations for that.
Do you think that rather than being born with these sort of skills and then becoming an architect because that fits your personality, do you think that it's something that you've cultivated over time subconsciously and to the point where now, you know that honesty and being realistic with clients and being open in communication, that that is the best way to go? It's not something that you were like, oh, I'm really good at this and like this matches my personality well.
No, I think that it is something that's, I think it needs to be practiced. So I don't think it's even just about sort of learning it and experiencing it. It's about practicing it. And making sure that you're, from discussions with people in the studio to discussions with clients and contractors, if you're not doing that on a regular basis, then you're firstly restricting your learning pool. The more you do it, the more you learn from it. But also, I think there's more chance of being caught out. And I think that with people in the studio, like we are, like Simon and I really like having people in the studio. We like the sort of interpersonal relationship. We want everyone to be talking to each other and looking over each other's shoulder and asking about problems. We like, at the moment, we've got our meeting table as part of our office. It's not in a separate room, which means that we have meetings and people are giving presentations and everyone who's sitting there hears it and they see it. And they can contribute to it as well. If they've got something useful, they can pop their head up and say, actually, on this project, we did this, or how about that? And they can come into a client meeting and, or we can ask their advice. So like Simon and I softly are always trying to encourage those sorts of interactions. And when we take people onto site, I'm always really aware of sort of modeling, you know, what I believe to be sort of good examples of communication to people we're working with. So, and then it works vice versa for people we're working with. They've got to put themselves in the position where they're exposed to that. There's no point them plugging in the headphones and not experience and not hearing it, or going to site and having their head in their notes. And it's always quite nerve-wracking, I think, to start with. Feedback we always have when people start going to site, or Simon and I say to them, we want you to lead this one, or you're, I'm on holiday, you're gonna have to do this one on your own. It's, people always say it's scary. And I remember when I first started doing it, it was the thought of talking to a builder who had many years more experience than me about like how they should be delivering this drawing that I've just drawn on a bit of paper.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
And you quickly learn that really the most successful way of doing it is having an atmosphere of collaboration mm-hmm. and communication.
Yeah.
And I think it needs practice.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what do you think are the sort of key characteristics for running your own business? We spoke a bit earlier about how, it begins with your love for architecture and then it turns into sort of just, you know, keeping the business alive. What advice would you give for anyone considering starting their own practice, being realistic and honest about the process?
What advice would I give? I think to start with, you've got to try and be a sponge for as long as you can mm-hmm. before you take the leap, so that you're giving yourself as much experience as possible of what it is to be able to run the sort of projects that we're running. So even if you're not dealing with the business side of it, just making sure that you've got down how to run a project of the type that you're doing. You might be setting up a business to do commercial fit outs. You might be setting up a business to do private residential.
Yeah.
I think it would be pretty tricky to do that without being able to run a project sort of with your eyes closed really before you do that. But you've got to be willing to take risks. You've got to be willing to put the work in.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't necessarily mean just time. I think I'm at like intensity. Like we're always keen, like within the studio, Simon and I, when we started, we wanted to make sure we didn't have like a late hours culture.
Mm.
We're really keen to break that within architecture.
Yeah.
And Simon is incredible at this because he is one of the most intense workers. I think him and my wife have both got the ability to sort of put their heads down like between 8 or 9 and 6 and just be phenomenally productive.
Mm.
And he achieves a lot and gets to go home at a reasonable hour.
Mm.
I'm okay at that,
yeah.
But I have to work a bit more flexibly. And there are times where I can work really, really intensively and times where I can't. So I can pick and choose and do that. But I think that's really key. You've got to, it can be tricky as well. You've got to have a good support network around you in terms of be it your family life or friends or things like that.
Yeah.
And to be able to be kind to yourself and be able to take time out properly so you don't burn out. And that is the first step of that is making sure you're not working crazy hours.
Yeah.
And the second step is understanding how you work and how to get the best out so that you can be incredibly productive.
Yeah.
And I think if you can work out how to do that, then it gives you a really great shot because you've got to juggle so many things to start with.
Yeah.
In particular. And you're learning an awful lot, especially as an architect.
Yeah.
We don't get taught business, really. We don't at all.
Yeah.
So you do learn a lot of that as you go.
Yeah. Would you, looking back, do you wish that you'd sort of taken any business course or anything? Or do you think that's just something you learn as you go along?
It's so hard to say because in architecture, you almost learn everything as you go along.
Mm.
You've probably heard this before. Like you learn, speculative projects at university
and
you learn how to detail real world buildings when you're in the workplace. So I feel like everything I've learned has been in the workplace anyway. So would I respond well to going on business courses? I think it would be foolish to say that it wouldn't be helpful.
Mm.
It's really tricky. I think architectural education is tough. Like it often gets accused of trying to churn out too many star architects
mm-hmm.
when the reality is it might be that 1 in 1,000 students gets to actually deliver the sort of thing they've learned.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does teach is ingenuity and creativity and problem solving
mm-hmm.
and the sort of levels of intensity that you might need to work at to be able to work profitably.
Yeah.
And things like that. So there are so many skills within education that I think are great. But if they threw in a business model module or two, it probably would be helpful.
Yeah.
Which was actually your question.
So how often do you sort of reconnect with your love of architecture and the creative side, the experimental side, and pull yourself away from the business and even just sort of unwinding from that, the financial and the business side of it?
Yeah. Well, I think Simon and I do still draw and scribble things when it comes to our designs. But I think more and more we live vicariously through the guys in the studio, which brings great joy. Mm-hmm. So I love it. I love sitting down next to somebody who's working through a design project, who's coming up with like new concepts, whether it's from the first stages to like intricate detailing of how a handrail meets a baluster or something like that. So I really enjoy being able to sit alongside people doing that and basically encouraging them to keep interrogating and questioning and exploring to get the sort of solutions that become successful.
Yeah.
So I think nowadays that's probably my main source of sort of design related satisfaction in seeing that and people develop in that way within the studio, which is great. Outside of work itself, I don't know. I think I've probably retreated from it slightly. I've got a young family. I didn't marry an architect. She has no interest in architecture, which I find very healthy for me. So aside from cultural things with the kids and the families generally, I do. Now I switch off from architecture more outside the office nowadays.
You're a fair weather cyclist or just a cyclist now, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was saying I should probably take off the fair weather bit. No, I cycle around a lot. I find it a great way. It's the quickest way to get around London. I think it's productive. I get thinking time while I'm cycling. Feel fresher when I get into the office, I think, than if I come in on a stuffy train. I love that.
So just to sort of wrap up, do you have a dream project or location or, you know, looking at the next sort of 5 years of work in your practice, like anything that you're looking forward to?
That is a very good question. A new question, have I thought of? A dream project for the office. You know what? I mean, I think a dream project, I always thought, so I grew up near Cambridge and I saw the amazing architecture like around the city, particularly the university architecture. And I think part of me always wanted to get like an Oxbridge commission. They seem to be amazing. An architect, Niall McLaughlin, has done a lot of them.
What's the name? Sorry?
Niall McLaughlin he's an architect who has done some wonderful work with both Oxford and Cambridge, I think. We had a field trip to Oxford to see a bunch of his work. But I think if we were pushing slightly out of the private residential and we managed to somehow magic a commission from one of the colleges, that would be incredible. And aside from that, new build houses are always fun, whether it's a tiny little urban site or, you know, we've got one in Hampshire at the moment, which is on a far, far bigger site with sprawling land and almost like very few restrictions. That's also fun. So yeah, new build house projects,
few restrictions,
always great.
Yeah.
Few or with restrictions is fun too.
So bring it either way. Yeah. Lovely. So I just wanted to finish with a quote that I found that reminded me of ethos on timelessness. And that was, architecture should speak of its time and place, but yearn for timelessness. And that's Frank Gehry, the guy who designed the Guggenheim.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that's where you got your inspiration from for the bio, right?
I must have done at some point.
Must have.
But it's a good statement. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wholeheartedly agree.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and insights with us today, John. Do you have anything sort of as a takeaway for young professionals who have sort of on the cusp of deciding whether to take architecture or not at university? Do you have sort of singular piece of advice for that journey?
I think it can be a really valuable and rewarding career if you embark upon it. I think you need to be tenacious and ambitious to get the most out of it. But if you're up for that, then you should give it a go and
it'll
be a riot.
Yeah. Lovely. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to learn from your experiences. And I'd like to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. And we will see you next time on The London Architect. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Liz.